Now, are you teaching at all anymore?
Not formally, but I teach a course for ELLA, the Edmonton Lifelong Learners Association. I taught one on climate change last year, and we had a great time. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and apparently so did they. So this year, I'm going to do another one, largely on the chemistry of our daily lives, and have some friends of mine come and talk. John Acorn is going to come and give a couple of lectures, which I know they're going to love, on bugs. So that kind of informal teaching. And also I go out to schools a lot and really enjoy interaction with children, and have high school classes and grade 9 classes come into the lab and do things in the chemistry lab.
Now, you've got the word diversity in your title. What does that mean?
It means that at the moment, we have a very large proportion of men, faculty members, and not very many women. Now, there are even fewer Aboriginal or people of colour. And the diversity really means try and increase the numbers of people who are underrepresented as members of the faculty, for my own sake, because that's quite a large thing to try and do. I've concentrated on trying to increase the number of women in faculty. And across the Faculty of Science at the moment, we have somewhere between 15 and 16% women, which is quite low.
And that is in the faculty, like staff members?
That's faculty members in the 7 departments in the Faculty of Science. And that includes biological sciences and science psychology. So, and these are higher, these are about 30%. So it means that in some of the areas where women are still quite non-traditional, they're quite low.
When you look back over your career here at the university, what changes have you seen in terms of women coming into science, for example?
Yeah, very large changes. When we started our Women in Science program 25 years ago, there were probably about 25% women in first-year science. Now there's 52. And so there's a huge change in that area. And even in the graduate students, master's program about 45, PhD about 38, postdoc a goodly drop off to the 17-18%, and then faculty down to 15%. So it's each transition in the educational system, there are fewer women choosing to go on to the next step. And of course that means that the pool of women who have the requirements for a faculty position is not very large.
Let's look at this in parts then. With the increase in people, in women, initially getting interested in university science, what do you think it is that's attracting them to science in the first place?
I think the teaching of science in high school has changed considerably, so that women begin to realize it's relevant to their own lives. Used to be, I remember looking at texts, and particularly texts in physics, and there were little men rolling weights up a hill to talk about momentum. And I thought, what young woman is going to feel this has got anything to do with her? Now, this is, we're thinking of 25, 30 years ago. And the other thing that used to happen was if there was an informal discussion after a science class, let's again use physics, because it's the example that has really changed. There used to be a discussion about maybe hockey pucks, and again, momentum and acceleration and all the rest of it. And so that would lead to discussion of the previous night's hockey game, which again, to some extent, is of more interest to the young men than it is to the young women. And so there was a sense that this is not so relevant to me. And so women were choosing not to study some of these sciences. Whereas now, if you look at the textbook in physics, it's very inclusive. They work very hard. The other major thing that's happened, and we know this affects women probably more than men, is the reason for studying something is explained before you start studying the theory. And the example that we use often, because it's such a good example, if you're trying to teach the physics of light, you can start by talking about how light travels and the theories of how it can be either wave motion or corpuscular motion, and you can look at the mathematics behind that, and then you can say at the end, oh, by the way, it's good for us to know how light travels because it tells us how we see, how our eyes work. Or you can do it completely the other way around and say, let's look at how our eyes work. And then you've got a reason for studying the way light travels. And so you haven't turned the students off before you got to talking about the application. And that's true in so many ways of teaching science, that if you start by getting the students really excited about something, the application of the science, then the theory is worth learning because they know why they're going to learn it. And there's an amazing example of this that we in the faculty have seen over quite a number of years now. Probably about 10 years ago, we followed the example of computing science and put internship programs into the departments of the Faculty of Science. And when I was in chemistry, I was responsible for the students going out on internship. And what that was, after their third year, they went out and spent 1 year working in an industry where they were using their chemistry. So it was chemistry related in some way. And it could be Environment Canada, or it could be Merck Frost, or it could be what was then Railo Chemicals here, now Gilead. So something to do with chemistry. They spent a whole year. When they came back to finish their fourth year of their studies, they consistently did better in their courses than they had done before they went out, because now they recognized why they were learning the chemistry. They'd seen the application of it. It seems so obvious, but it's hard when you become terribly excited about a particular discipline and you're teaching it to students. You forget that you're excited about it, therefore you're interested regardless of whether you start with theory and all the rest of it, whereas you've got to grab the interest of the students first. And if we can do that, then we get students going on and becoming very interested.
Now, you take that, you have more women interested in sciences because the presentation is different. But then as you move through the graduate levels, master's and PhD and then postdocs, what's happening there?
Women are completing their bachelor's degrees as effectively as men. In other words, we've got the same proportion of women completing their degree. But then they have to consider whether or not they want to go on and do, first of all, a master's and then a PhD. And women recognize that at some stage they may want to get married and have families. And they watch as undergraduates, they often hear from their teaching assistants in the lab what it's like being a graduate student. It's a busy life and it's fairly committed. And sometimes they watch their faculty teachers and the lifestyle they have. And I think women are saying, well, maybe that's not what I want to choose. And so they're finding work which gives them a little more flexibility and allows them to work from 8:30 till 4:30 without being committed to working much longer hours than that or much different hours, you know, having to be there when there's an experiment running, which is a little more difficult if you've got a family to look after.
Is that something that is only within the sciences, or is that something for women that applies across the various disciplines?
I think it's a little more in the sciences, just because of the nature of the research that most of us do, which is experimental. The theoretical research, you have perhaps more freedom to do it at home or on computer, and so that makes a little bit of a difference, although I don't think we've seen many more women choosing to do theoretical research. But if you're in an area where you're not having to be in a laboratory supervising or working with a supervisor or supervising students, it does make it a bit more flexible. Whereas in science, you some of your work has to be governed by the experiments and the timing that they have. If something needs to run for 12 hours, you've just got to be prepared to be there after 12 hours and keep the experiment running.
How are you attacking this problem of trying to still increase the proportion of women who are, staying on with their postdocs and then becoming faculty members?
In a number of different ways. I think we still have to be intentional in hiring women. One of the reasons I say that is if there's an outstanding woman in particularly computing science, chemistry, physics, math, earth and atmospheric sciences, the kind of woman that we would want to hire, she can go to many different universities. We're not the only university that is saying, let's hire more women. And so we have to be, as I say, intentional, that we want to try and hire this woman. And therefore, we take steps to make sure that it will be possible for her to choose the University of Alberta. In other words, that we don't delay too long so that she's got offers from all sorts of other places, and they're saying, you have to make up your mind now. And we learned that. We know that. And departments are doing very well in saying, if there's a woman we really want, we've got to be fast and move quickly and get all the interviews done and make the offer quickly. And then at least we're in with a chance. And, well, we have to admit that University of British Columbia is geographically probably a little more attractive than the University of Alberta. I hate to say that, because I have great loyalty to the University of Alberta. And when young women come and I have the opportunity to sit down and talk with them, we talk a lot about the quality of life in Edmonton, especially for young families, because I really believe it's very, very good. We have a very good educational system. We've got lots of things to do. We've got lots of music and drama and art and all the rest of it. And I think that's important for young families when women are choosing where they might want to go to university. And the other thing that more and more, the University of Alberta is developing a very, very strong reputation in the sciences. And so women come and discover the excitement of some of the departments here in science and get excited about coming here. And so we're able to attract women here, which is great, but it's still a tough competition.
People can't think of you without thinking of the group Wisest. And how many years is it now? Is it 25 years?
25 years. We celebrated our 25th anniversary last October.
What are the accomplishments that stand out for you with this group?
More and more, I'm beginning to discover what influence the programs that we put in place have. And if anybody had asked me when we started some of them, I would have been surprised. The most obvious one is the summer research program, where students from grade 11 come and spend 6 weeks working in a research group at the university and doing a project. When I think back and think of the parameters that we put in place right from the beginning, we said the student who comes in is going to have a project. They're not going to be a helper. They're not going to wash dishes. They're not going to do something very routine all the time. They're going to actually be part of the project. And the faculty have been very, very good in coming up with projects which are completely appropriate for students in grade 11. These are very bright students. And in fact, one faculty member said to me not too long ago, sometimes I would rather have a Wisest student than a graduate student, because the Wisest student comes in with enthusiasm, no bad habits, and they work in exactly the way that we want them to work, so we can teach them, and they're great. And that was awfully good to hear. I mean, oh goodness, they're only around for 6 weeks, but they're quite remarkable young women. And so we were interested to see, what effect does working for 6 weeks in a research lab have on your future career and decision-making? And so the 1994 group of Wisest Summer Research Program students, we compared with a group who spent one day on the university and a group who had nothing. And these were out of the applications to the WISES summer program, which were about 250 at that time. We took the top 150, and then we randomly assigned 50 to the WISES summer research program, 50 to one day at the university, and 50 to nothing. So it was a hard thing to do, but that's how we did it. And then we followed those three cohorts. And we discovered, after following them as much as we could for 10 years, you lose an awful lot of people at that stage, because these are young people who are moving around all over the world. And I remember the research team said they had to phone somebody in Chile and they had to phone somebody in Australia. And so it got very difficult to keep the numbers up, particularly of the group who got nothing, because they had no loyalty to this research project. But we discovered that the commitment of the young women who had spent the 6 weeks at the University of Alberta was considerably stronger to the sciences and engineering than it was of the other groups. One of the things that we had to recognize, all of the young women who apply for the WISES Summer Research Program do so because they're interested in science in the first place. And the ones who are selected, and even the 150, are all doing very well in the sciences. So the chances of them going on in and doing a BSc in science is very, very high. And so we weren't changing that very much. And we recognized that this group were already self-selected as going into science. But it was particularly the numbers who went on and did a PhD and the numbers who might go on and do a postdoc. And by the time we got to looking at that, the numbers were getting quite small, but there were more of the young women from the summer research program group who continued on and went right through and did postdocs. And as I say, what really came through was this commitment. They were going to go on in their careers in sciences and engineering, whereas the others were not quite as committed.
You've got some exciting news for WISEST. It's going to expand. What's happening?
Well, yes, that's one way of putting it. WISEST, for the last 20 years, has belonged to a group called CC West, which is the Canadian Coalition of Women in Engineering, Science, Trades, and Technology. And that is a coalition of 27 groups across the country, like WISEST. And as I say, WISEST is a member of it. And this group has been around for 20 years. And the reason it was founded was all of these 27 groups are doing wonderful things in their local area. And we felt it was important that there be some opportunity for them to share what they're doing, so that if another group could do the same thing, they could take it and make it their own and then use it. So it was good for people to share what they were doing. So that's what's been going on for quite some time. And they had conferences every 2 years so that people again from across the country can get together and talk about their concerns, what's successful, and just meet one another. And those conferences have been great, and CC West has been doing very well. 5 years ago, we said CC West now is at a stage where it's ready to look for something more than this. And about that time in Britain, there was a centre for women in science and engineering set up. And there's been one in Australia, one in Germany, one in the States. And we thought, it's time for us to have a Canadian centre, because that means then we have a national group which can pull together data, which can help support the groups at the local level, which can add value to what they're doing, because there would be an initiative coming also from the centre. So 5 years ago, we began the journey of moving towards a Canadian Centre for Women in Science, Engineering, Trades and Technology. And we've done it from the grassroots level up. The very first thing we did was have consultations all across the country with stakeholders. So they're mostly women in the sciences and engineering, in business, in trade unions, in industry, in education, came together. And we talked and we had, of course, all sorts of questionnaires for them, and asking them, if we go in this direction, what kind of things would be of interest? And we found there was a strong support for the centre. People felt that there needed to be a focus, that information and activities. So about 18 months ago, we started with support from Status of Women Canada, and they've supported the project all the way through. We started a pilot project of the kind of activities that the centre would actually undertake. And these are symposia for women in engineering, looking at moving ahead in the profession, because we often talk about the glass ceiling, and some of it is still there. So just talking about the various barriers that there are. And what was a little surprising, this was in Calgary, and it was two oil companies whose engineers came together, women engineers. And what we discovered was, we should have recognized this, engineering, big engineering firms work with teams of people. And often there's only one woman in each of these teams. And when we brought them all together, some of them hadn't known one another, hadn't talked to one another. And they told us at the end of the day, they'd enjoyed the day a lot in the discussions, very much roundtable discussions. But one of the things that was most important to them was the opportunity to sit down and talk with people in their own company and get to know them. And that their plan was to continue that. So that's certainly one of the things that we would go on doing. The other things are workshops for employers, and we have a thing called a checklist of things that employers do in their workplace to try and decide what makes it friendly, particularly to women. But it's been shown over and over again, when the workplace is friendly to women, it's friendly to everybody. And so there's a discussion at the workshop with the employers, just looking at the kinds of things, the kind of questions that you can ask about the workplace and about what its effect is on the people who work there. So we've done several of those across the country, in Saskatchewan, in Newfoundland, and also workshops with unions, looking at how they can work with women to encourage them into the workplace. We're particularly concerned now about the trades, because there's only 4% of women in construction trades. And so we're looking for all sorts of ways to increase that.
And the centre, is it going to be headquartered in Edmonton?
It is, because the Alberta government has given us a little bit of money as a start. And so we're going to have an office in Edmonton. It will really be a virtual centre. It's not going to be a centre with a whole lot of people working for it. It's going to be a centre which very much adds value to the 27 groups. And so when a workshop needs to be done, we'll be looking for a group in the area of the workshop that might be prepared to take it on, or we'll be contracting with somebody to do that workshop. So it will be very much a small, ongoing staff, and eventually probably small offices across the country, satellite offices. But the sort of national office will be in Edmonton, because, as I say, the Alberta government must have been the first one to come through.
Just before you came back to the office today, you were over at Windsor Park School with some kids talking about science. What were you talking to them about?
You know, I wasn't doing a lot of talking. One of the great joys of my life has been going out to schools and having fun with chemistry. And that means I can take all sorts of colourful demonstrations or interesting demonstrations that, as far as possible, I get the children involved in as well. And so I was doing some of those this morning, and I was having a lot of fun. And one of them, just as an example, while they were making nylon, you know, and it still is amazing to me that I can go to the gym in Windsor Park School and take a few chemicals with me and have two grade threes and then two grade fives make nylon. And they get quite excited when, out of a beaker, they can pull a thread of nylon.
Now, how do you do that? Because I don't know.
Well, that's what's so wonderful, particularly with grade fives. The curriculum of the Alberta education includes a lot of chemistry in grade five. And so we can talk about molecules. And we can talk about the fact that nylon is made from two small molecules. And these two small molecules are in some way like people. They've got two arms. That means they can all join up together in a long, long line. And of course, I always have the children join up. And nylon, in chemical terms, is called a polymer. And that just means it's many molecules. And so we have such fun. I tell the children when they're all joined up with their hands that now they're a poly people. But you see, I think they'll remember that. So they remember poly means many. And they remember that, oh, a polymer is many something or other. And they know about molecules. So we've got the idea of the many molecules and this long chain, which is why you get a thread of nylon. So all I have to do is take the one molecule, and it's in water in a solution, and the other molecule, which is a little liquid, and we count the number of drops, and it's 28 drops that we use in our reaction to make nylon. And then we get this great roll of nylon, which in a way looks like a cocoon that a silkworm would make. So that allows us to talk about what's the difference between the silkworm making silk and us making nylon. And there's not a lot. You know, we talk about one is natural and one is synthetic, but the principle behind it, the silkworm is doing a very complex chemical reaction in the same way that we're doing a more straightforward one.
And what's the magic ingredient in those 28 drops?
It's called sebacil chloride, which doesn't tell you anything. It's one of these trite names, but it's a molecule which has the two arms are at the end, and they're acid chlorides. And it's actually very straightforward. The other molecule is an amine, the things that gives fish their smells. And what happens when you put the two molecules together, they push out a molecule of hydrogen chloride, and the molecules join up together. So the arms come about, or the linking comes about from pushing out the molecule of hydrogen chloride. And you get this long chain forming.
Margaret, thank you very much.
My pleasure.